Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's Risk-Based Pricing Notices webcast. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Jason Liu. Jason, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Scott. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Outlook Live, the Federal Reserve System's audio conference series on consumer compliance topics. My name is Jason Liu, and I am a senior examiner at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. It is my pleasure to be opening today's webinar on risk-based pricing notices. Today we have Mandy Aubrey, a senior attorney at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and Rebecca Reagan, a senior examiner at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. Before I hand things over to Mandy and Rebecca, I want to mention some administrative and logistical details. This Outlook Live session is delivered using a webinar format. You should be receiving both the audio and video via your computer. With the webinar format, we will be advancing the slides during the event. However, there are a number of slides with forms and disclosures from the Federal Register that may not be viewable in the webinar format. Since the presenters will be going into the forms in some detail, we recommend you download the presentation using the link on the event player to view those specific slides. This will help since the downloaded PDF file may be expanded for better viewing. Today's webcast and audio feed will be archived and will be available for playback in a few days through our website, www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. The format today is for Mandy and Rebecca to walk through their presentation that should last approximately 45 minutes, leaving us about 15 minutes for a Q&A session. We received a number of email questions prior to today's presentation. At any time during the event, you may also use the online chat feature to submit additional questions. We will do our best to cover as many of the questions as possible, but please understand we may not be able to get to all of them. That wraps up my introductory remarks. So with that, Mandy, I'll turn things over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason, and good afternoon, everyone. As Jason discussed, today, Rebecca and I will be providing an overview of the risk-based pricing rules. We certainly hope that today's talk will provide some clarity about these rules, but I'll need to start with a statement that the opinions expressed in this presentation are intended for informational purposes only and are not formal opinions of or binding on the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis or the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, or the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. So with that, can we go to slide number two, please? You can see from the agenda today that we'll be discussing several of the major topics from the risk-based pricing rules. We'll go over risk-based pricing notices, credit score disclosures, account review notices, exceptions to the rules and some of the rules of construction, and then finally, you'll get some information about how these rules are enforced. Slide three, please. Let me first start with some of the basics of the risk-based pricing rule. The risk-based pricing rules are a joint rulemaking that the Federal Reserve Board did in conjunction with the Federal Trade Commission. The rules implemented the risk-based pricing requirements of the FACT Act, which amended the Fair Credit Reporting Act. You may know that as FCRA. The rules were finalized in January of 2010, and the effective date was January 1st, 2011. So we're about a month and a half past the mandatory compliance date. Before Rebecca and I provide some information about the rules, I want to take a minute to step back and provide some context about what prompted the statutory amendments. Historically, credit decisions were more straightforward decisions, so consumers with strong credit histories generally would be granted credit, and consumers with imperfect credit histories were denied credit. Those consumers who were denied credit would receive adverse action notices. However, the practice of risk-based pricing grew over time, and as you are probably aware, risk-based pricing is the practice of where a creditor sets or adjusts the price of credit granted to a consumer to reflect the risk of non-payment by that consumer. So now, instead of a straightforward acceptance or denial of credit, many consumers with imperfect credit histories would now receive credit, but they would do so on less favorable terms than consumers with better credit histories. There was a concern that consumers who in the past would have been denied credit and received adverse action notices would no longer become aware of how their credit history influenced a credit decision. So Congress decided to fill this gap with the risk-based pricing requirement changes to the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Slide four, please. So what does the rule actually require? The rule basically requires that in the context of consumer credit, when creditors use credit reports to risk-based price consumers, they're required to notify those consumers who received less favorable terms that information in their credit report has negatively influenced the price of their credit. However, as you can see from the slide, the rule itself is a bit more complicated to decipher. So you'll see the rule requires the provision of a risk-based pricing notice to a consumer if any person uses a consumer report in connection with an extension of credit for personal, family, or household purposes, and based on the report, extends credit to the consumer on material terms that are less favorable than the most favorable terms available to a substantial proportion of consumers. So you'll notice a number of concepts: material terms, most favorable terms, substantial proportion of consumers, that would potentially pose challenges for compliance. And so with that background, I'll get into the nuts and bolts of the rule requirements and how the final rules try to provide several options in order to help facilitate compliance with these requirements. Slide five, please. One of the first questions to answer in thinking about this rule is, who is responsible for providing these notices? The rules provide that when there is risk-based pricing in which a credit report is used, the original creditor, who is the person to whom the obligation is initially payable, has the compliance responsibility. In many transactions, the original creditor is clear. There is one apparent creditor and one consumer. So if a consumer walks into your bank and applies for a loan with you, it's going to be pretty clear that you'd be the original creditor and have responsibility for complying with the rule. But where this original creditor rule is particularly helpful is when there are more than two parties involved. And some of the questions we got in advance asked about the auto lending context. This is where the original creditor rule really comes in handy. So again, the obligation is on the original creditor, and this is true even if the credit agreement is immediately assigned to another party, such as a bank or a financing source. In three-party auto financing, a dealer is often the original creditor, even when it immediately signs the credit agreement for an auto loan to a bank or other financing source. But because they're the original creditor, the dealer has the compliance responsibility. However, in two-party auto financing, an auto dealer may act on behalf of a bank, but the bank may be the original creditor who ultimately has the responsibility to comply with the rules. For those of you who might be listening from Ohio, this is a common arrangement in your state. The problem is, in practice, these transactions may look very similar. They may both happen at a dealership, but the difference between them is really determined based on the terms of the contract, and again, who is the ultimate original creditor. And this distinction is key when determining whether, for instance, a bank has the responsibility to comply with the rules in these types of circumstances. Next slide, please. So now you've determined who has the responsibility for compliance, and say your institution does have the responsibility, then what? The next step is to determine what path you will take to comply with these rules. In order to provide flexibility to all of the different types of creditors who are covered by this rule, a major component of the risk-based pricing rule is compliance alternatives. So a creditor has two choices. You can either provide risk-based pricing notices, or you can provide credit score disclosures. Creditors who give risk-based pricing notices must give the notices only to those consumers who receive less favorable terms of credit based on a consumer report. So the notice will only be given to some consumers. In the alternative, creditors may choose to give credit score disclosures, which may generally be given to all consumers without having to analyze who received more or less favorable terms. Now, I'm going to talk first about how you can comply with the rules if you choose the risk-based pricing notices, and then Rebecca will talk more about the credit score disclosures. Slide 7, please. There are three methods provided in the rule for determining what consumers receive less favorable material terms based on information in their credit report. So creditors can determine who gets a risk-based pricing notice. These three are the direct comparison method, the credit score proxy method, and the tiered pricing method. Next slide, please. In order to discuss each of these methods, there are a couple of definitions you'll need to understand, the first of which is the definition of material terms. The rule requires creditors to determine whether material terms given to one consumer are less favorable than those given to other consumers. These methods are a way to perform that comparison. But comparing multiple material credit terms would be difficult, if not impossible. As a result, the rule essentially boils down the concept of material terms to the annual percentage rate, that there is a single term that can be used that can be compared when determining who got more or less favorable material terms. Now, as you can see, there are some more specific parameters depending on what type of credit you're dealing with. So for open-end credit, the rule makes clear that it excludes any promotional rate, penalty rate, or fixed rate HELOC option. For credit cards, the rule says that when we're talking about APR, we mean the purchase APR. And then if there is no purchase annual percentage rate, then the material term would be the APR that varies based on information in a consumer report, and that has the most significant financial impact on consumers. So you start to get into some judgment call with that definition. For credit for which there is no APR, such as with a utility or a charge card, then the material term is the term that varies based on a consumer report and that has the most significant financial impact on consumers. So the rule provides some examples. For example, for in the case of a utility, that might be the deposit that's required. Or in the case of a charge card, it might be the annual membership fee. Slide 9, please. The other important term to know is the definition of specific type of credit product. When comparing one consumer's APR to other consumers' APRs, the rule makes clear that the comparison should be limited to those consumers who are granted credit for a specific type of credit product. This term is defined as one or more credit products with similar features that are designed for similar purposes. And there are some examples there on the slide that are also provided in the rules that can give you some idea of what a specific type of credit product might look like. In practice, what this would mean is that consumers granted, for example, student loans should only be compared to other consumers granted student loans, where a student loan is determined to be the specific type of credit product. Next slide, please. With these definitions in mind, the first possible method a creditor may use is the direct comparison method. This method essentially would require a creditor to follow the general rule and directly compare the APRs granted to different consumers for a specific type of credit product. Now, this is going to require a case-by-case comparison. We provide some guidance in the preamble to the rule on some considerations you would take into account if you were to decide to use the direct comparison method. In reality, though, we expect that very few creditors will take this approach, especially given sort of the case-by-case nature of the direct comparison method. So in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on discussing some of the other comparison methods that you may be more likely to want to use. Slide 11, please. The second method that a creditor can choose to determine which consumers must receive a risk-based pricing notice is the credit score proxy method. In this method, a creditor that uses credit scores would determine a credit score that serves as a cutoff. So all of the consumers who have credit scores lower than that cutoff score would receive risk-based pricing notices. So how do you determine that cutoff score? Well, the rule provides that this would happen at the point at which approximately 60% of a creditor's consumers have lower credit scores and 40% of the creditor's consumers have higher credit scores. Now, these percentages must be based on the scores or all or a representative sample of the consumers to whom it has granted credit for a specific type of credit product. And this cutoff score must be recalculated at least every 2 years. So I think an example would help. Let's say a creditor takes a sample of how it has historically granted credit to its consumers. And there it finds that 40% of its consumers for a specific type of credit product have a credit score of 740 or above, which would mean that 60% have a lower credit score. In this circumstance, a creditor using the credit score proxy method would give the notice to all consumers whose score is below 740. The rule also provides that for creditors using this method, if a consumer has no score and the creditor typically uses the credit score proxy method, creditors must assume that the consumer gets credit on less favorable terms and provide a notice to that consumer. Slide 12, please. The rule set forth an alternative approach to setting the cutoff score under this credit score proxy method. So this is actually an alternative approach to the credit score proxy method. Final rules allow a creditor to deviate from this 40%-60% split and instead choose to set its cutoff score at a point that reflects its historical lending experience, but only in cases where more than 40% of consumers receive the most favorable terms. Again, I think an example would be helpful here. So let's say a creditor who wants to use this method, and they could choose to demonstrate, for example, that 80% of its consumers received its lowest APR and 20% of its consumers received an APR that was higher than that. Therefore, the creditor could set the cutoff score at the point that would result in 20% of its consumers receiving the risk-based pricing notice. Slide 13, please. In addition to the credit score proxy method, the final rule allows a third tiered pricing method. Now, this method is geared toward those creditors that assign consumers to pricing tiers. So, for instance, if you use rate sheets, this might be a good option. Under this method, a creditor assigns each consumer to one of several pricing tiers based on a consumer report. For example, a pricing tier may reflect APRs of 6%, 8%, 10%, and 12%. Under the final rules, A creditor may provide a notice to each consumer who is not assigned the top tier or tiers. And if there are four or less pricing tiers, then all of the consumers except those with APRs in the top tier, and by top tier I mean the lowest APR offered, would get a risk-based pricing notice. And if there are five or more pricing tiers, then all consumers except those with APRs in the top two tiers would get notices, plus any other tier that represents between 30 and 40% of the total number of tiers. So again, a couple of examples. If a creditor has five tiers, five different APRs, the risk-based pricing notices would be given to consumers in the three highest price tiers, which therefore means it would not be given to those in the top two lowest price tiers. But a creditor that has nine tiers with nine different APRs, the risk-based pricing notices would be given to the consumers in the six highest price tiers and not given to those in the top three tiers, because those three tiers represent between 30 and 40% of the total number of tiers. Slide 14, please. This next slide is pertinent if we have some credit card issuers with us today. In the case of credit cards, a credit card issuer may use any of the methods that I've just discussed to determine which credit card customers must receive a notice. But alternatively, a credit card issuer may provide a risk-based pricing notice using another type of method. And so they would provide a risk-based pricing notice when a consumer applies for a credit card for which more than one APR is offered, and the credit card issuer then provides a card to the consumer with a rate that is greater than the lowest APR offered. The rule also clarifies that there are a couple of times where no notice is required, and this is when a consumer applies for a card that is only offered at a single APR, or in a case where an issuer offers the lowest rate on an offer, even if the issuer offers a lower rate under a different credit card offer. Slide 15, please. And again, here you're going to see a risk-based pricing model notice, which, as Jason mentioned at the top of the program, you may be able to see a little bit better on the PDF version. Model notices are provided for all of the forms permitted under the rule. As I mentioned, this one shows a copy of the risk-based pricing model notice, and I'll just highlight a couple of the key elements in this notice. First, this form tells a consumer that they've received less favorable terms than are offered to other consumers based on information in their credit report. The form also provides the consumer with a right to a free credit report and information on how to obtain it. And this is in addition to the free annual report that is provided to all consumers. The notice also provides information on how to dispute mistakes on the report, if any are found. Finally, there's some educational information about credit reports and references to the board and FTC websites for further information about credit reports. Slide 16, please. Again, model forms are not required, but these model forms do provide a safe harbor to creditors who are using them. The creditors must provide all content in the forms in a clear and conspicuous manner. The rule also provides that the risk-based pricing disclosures can be provided in writing, electronically, or orally. Now, this is important to note because the rule allows these disclosures to be given electronically, which would mean that you would not need to comply with eSign to give these risk-based pricing notices electronically. However, as Rebecca will talk about shortly, this is not the case for credit score disclosures. Slide 17. The risk-based pricing notices have timing requirements that depend on the type of credit given, and there are some special rules for certain types of transactions. First, for closed-end credit, the rule provides that the notice must be given no earlier than when the approval is communicated to the consumer, but no later than consummation of the loan. In open-end credit, the notice must be given no earlier than when the approval is communicated to the consumer, but before the first transaction is made. There are some special rules that address both instant credit and auto lending in this rule. And I should note that these particular special rules apply not only to risk-based pricing notices, but also to the credit score disclosures that Rebecca will be talking about in a moment. The special rule for instant credit is provided to address situations where open-end credit is granted in person or by telephone for financing goods or services instantly. A typical example would be a consumer that applies for a store credit card at a cash register in order to finance their purchase. In writing the rule, the agencies were concerned about some of the practical and privacy issues with a store clerk, for instance, providing a notice to the consumer. Therefore, the rule provides that in those circumstances, a creditor may provide a notice either at the time of the first mailing to the consumer, such as when the plastic credit card is mailed, but in any case, no later than 30 days after the credit decision is made. There are also some rules for auto lending that apply, and the rules address particularly the two-party financing situations that I talked about earlier, where a bank would be the original creditor but needs the help of an auto dealer to act on the bank's behalf in providing the disclosures. So what the rule says is that the bank may arrange to have the auto dealer provide the notice on its behalf as long as it maintains reasonable policies and procedures to verify that the dealer is indeed meeting the timing requirements under the rule. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca to talk about credit score disclosures on slide 18.
Thanks, Mandy. Good afternoon, everyone. As Mandy indicated, I'll be talking about the credit score disclosure path to compliance with this section. Instead of determining which consumers require a risk-based pricing notice, credit score disclosures generally must be given to all consumers applying for credit. We received a number of questions concerning this language given to all consumers, and a simpler way of thinking about this is that you would need to give these disclosures to everyone, even those who may have received the most favorable rate. In addition to the model risk-based pricing notices, the agencies develop model credit score disclosures, which may be used by creditors. These model forms are found in the Federal Register. Slide 19, please. The three model forms are the H3 for mortgage products, H4 for non-mortgage products, and H5 when no credit score is available. Use of these forms provides a safe harbor for the creditor. Slide 20, please. This slide discusses the form requirements for the disclosure. It must be clear and conspicuous, segregated from other information provided to the consumer. However, with respect to the H3 model form for mortgage products, that particular disclosure combines the credit score disclosures with those required by 609G of FCRA. The disclosures must be provided in writing and in a form the consumer can keep. A credit score disclosure complying with eSign satisfies the in-writing requirement. This is something that Mandy referred to earlier. Slide 21, please. With respect to timing, For mortgage products, the credit score disclosure must be provided at the same time as the disclosures required by 609G. And that standard is as soon as reasonably practicable after the credit score is obtained. Similarly, for non-mortgage products, the credit score must be provided as soon as reasonably practicable. However, because of the different nature of these two types of products, the actual day that the credit score is provided may be different depending on application processing time. Slide 22, please. Slide is an image of the H3 mortgage credit score disclosure form. And then on slide 24, this is the accompanying 609G disclosure. And then on slide 25, I briefly will talk about the relationship between the H3 and the 609G disclosures. If a lender uses the model form H3, it's intended to be compliant with the provisions of 609G, which require disclosures of the credit score and other information about that credit score. Slide 25, please. This slide shows the H4 form for non-mortgage products. And then on slide 26, I'm going to just briefly talk about the content of the H3 and H4 model forms. Both forms explain that credit scores are affected by a consumer's credit history and the fact that the credit score can affect the availability and cost of credit. The forms provide the consumer's credit score and compare that score with the distribution of credit scores among consumers. This can be shown in a graphical form or through a clear and readily understandable statement. The forms also inform the consumer how his or her credit score compares with the scores of other consumers. Slide 27, please. Additionally, the disclosures include a statement encouraging the consumer to verify the accuracy of the information in their report, a statement of the consumer's right to dispute any information in the report, and information on how to obtain the report. Slide 28 is the last credit score disclosure model form. This is the H5 for use when no credit score is available. Slide 29, please. The model notice H5 is to be used when a credit score is not available from the consumer reporting agency from which the creditor regularly obtains credit scores, and the creditor does not obtain a score from another agency. And then just as a caveat, there's no obligation for the creditor to pull a score from another consumer reporting agency, but must disclose a score if one is obtained. H5 disclosure states that a credit score was unavailable, which may indicate a lack of credit history. Other disclosures describe what the credit scores are, why they are important, and how to obtain a copy of the consumer's report. Slide 30. This slide discusses how to comply when multiple credit scores are pulled. If a creditor obtains two or more credit scores for a consumer and uses one of those scores as the basis for setting material terms, that score must be disclosed. If instead the creditor uses multiple scores to set the material terms, the creditor may disclose one of the scores obtained or may disclose more than one. However, whichever method the creditor uses, they need to ensure that the information specified in Section 222.74 D and E, which is basically the content that I described in model H3 and H4, that must be provided with the credit score. Slide 31, please. Now, after an account is open, certain actions taken by the creditor would require them to provide an account review notice. If a creditor does an account review of an existing customer and based in whole or part on a consumer's report increases the account's APR, then the creditor at that time must provide the consumer with an account review notice. This notice must be provided regardless of whether the creditor typically provides either risk-based pricing notices or credit score disclosures. Typically, this occurs in the credit card context, but may occur for other types of products as well. Slide 32 has an image of the model form for account review notices, an H2 format. On slide 33, this lists the delivery requirements for the account review notice. The form, the use of the model form, which we just looked at, provides a safe harbor. The notice must be clear and conspicuous, provided to the consumer in writing, electronically, or orally, and there are no e-sign requirements. For timing, this notice must be provided at the time the decision to increase the APR is communicated to the consumer. Slide 34 details what to do in the case of multiple consumers applying for a credit product. And there, keep in mind that there are differences between the risk-based pricing notice and the credit score disclosure notice. In the case of the risk-based pricing notice, a creditor must provide a notice to each consumer to satisfy the requirements of the section. If the consumers have the same address, a creditor may satisfy the requirements by providing a single risk-based pricing notice addressed to both consumers. However, credit score disclosures have different requirements. When a transaction involves two or more consumers, the creditor must provide a separate disclosure to each consumer to satisfy the exceptions in the requirement, regardless of whether the consumers have the same address. And we'll get into a little more detail with this during the Q&A section, but it generally means that separate envelopes would have to go to the co-applicants if they're at the same address. Slide 35. A consumer is entitled to only one notice per extension of credit, unless the creditor must provide an account review notice to the consumer at a later date. 36 discusses the exceptions to complying with the risk-based pricing notices or the credit score disclosure notices. If a consumer applies for specific material terms and is granted those terms, unless those terms were specified by the creditor using a consumer report after the consumer applied for or requested credit. The second exception would be when a creditor obtains a consumer report that is a pre-screened credit list and uses that report to make a firm offer of credit. The third exception would be if a creditor provides an adverse action notice to the consumer under Section 615A of FCRA. Slide 37, please. Regarding enforcement, there's no private right of action for violations of the risk-based pricing rules. However, the rule is subject to regulatory enforcement actions. And that concludes the presentation segment. So now I'll transition to the Q&A section, and I'll start with some of the questions we have received. We tried to group these questions together depending on the topic addressed. We did receive quite a few questions about whether notices needed to be provided to denied applicants. If an adverse action notice is provided to an applicant, that qualifies as one of the exceptions where notices need not be provided. One thing to keep in mind, though, is even if the adverse action notice is provided, you would still continue to provide the 609G disclosures. However, the timing requirements for the credit score disclosures must be followed even if a creditor does not yet know if it will ultimately deny a loan. This would most likely take place in the mortgage area, an applicant could be provided the notice as soon as required under the rules, but then due to lengthy application processing times, the applicant would ultimately be declined. The practical result would be providing a credit score disclosure to ensure it meets the timing requirements and then turning around and giving an adverse action notice because the loan was later declined.
Okay, Rebecca, and I'll take a couple of the questions that were asked about some other circumstances where a risk-based pricing notice or other type of notice might not necessarily need to be provided. I guess one of the basic questions, which is a good question, if I don't use a credit report at all, is there a risk-based pricing notice requirement? And that's a good fundamental question that, again, this is geared toward pricing that is based in whole or in part on a consumer report. So if you don't use a consumer report when you make a credit decision, then the risk-based pricing requirement wouldn't apply. We've gotten several questions about some language that was actually, I think, in the preamble to our rule, where it said credit score disclosures should be provided to all applicants. I think that language was there to sort of distinguish between the fact that risk-based pricing notices are only going to be given to those who get less favorable terms, whereas the credit score disclosures can generally be given, you know, without analysis, just given generally to all consumers. But as, you know, Rebecca's discussed, there would not be a requirement, for instance, to disclose the credit score disclosure if an adverse action notice was given. We've also received some questions about creditors who they typically provide credit score disclosures, but in some instances, for whatever reason, may not use a credit report to price, you know, a few or some of the loans. So they may not rely on a credit report in those circumstances. And the question is, would a credit score disclosure still need to be provided in those circumstances? The answer would be no, since the rule would not otherwise apply because the credit score or the credit report was not used in you know, pricing the loan at all, then a credit score disclosure would not need to be provided.
The next question I'll address has to do with record retention. While there's no specific record retention requirements with respect to the notices, banks are going to have to demonstrate compliance with the provisions to their respective regulatory authorities. And I would think that one method of doing that would be to have a copy of the notice in the file.
Okay. We've also gotten several questions about whether separate envelopes are required when mailing a credit score disclosure to two borrowers at the same address. So what the rule requires is that a separate notice be provided to each consumer for credit score disclosures. Whereas the risk-based pricing notices, it specifically provides that if there are two consumers at the same address, that, you know, you can give a single one of the risk-based pricing notices, you know, addressed to both consumers. The rule, again, talks about a separate notice for the credit score disclosures. I think the agencies would expect that a creditor would make an effort to keep these disclosures separate from each other, especially really given the credit score and the related information in the disclosures. You know, that's more sensitive consumer-specific information. So I think separate envelopes are a good idea to try to achieve this, even when the disclosures are going to the same address. Obviously, to address another one of the questions, this is going to be harder to do in the case of an email address. Because obviously you can't use an envelope. I think there, you know, it's hard to sort of provide one way that it could work, but I think it's going to be important to demonstrate that you have made an effort to try to keep these separate to the extent possible, even when you've got a single email address that you're providing these disclosures to.
The next question is, what if a bank pulls a credit report but uses it to approve or deny the loan but not to price the loan? The answer to that would be if the decision is simply to approve or deny, then notices would not be required. Instead, adverse action notices would be required for denied applications.
And I'll just jump in here and, you know, where someone's using a, like Rebecca's saying, just to using a consumer report just to approve or deny the loan, you know, there's not any pricing involved. I just want to caution you about pulling a credit report and having some variable pricing involved. For example, say a bank pulls a consumer report but does not actually use the consumer report information to provide different prices to different consumers. There's going to be a presumption when this different pricing is being used that the consumer report, because it was pulled, may have been used in whole or in part in pricing that loan. And that's going to be something that needs to be demonstrated then to your examiner that you did not actually use the consumer report in the pricing of the loan. So just to throw a red flag there, just that's going to be something that you're going to need to be able to demonstrate, and a risk that you may actually be taking when you're pulling a consumer report, but nevertheless are pricing different consumers in different ways. We've also gotten some other questions about stale credit reports. So a number of situations that have come in about if a credit report was pulled previously for another loan, and then the consumer comes in few months later and that same credit report was used again to price a completely different loan. So bank just chooses not to pull a fresh credit report and instead uses this older credit report. And the question would be, would the risk-based pricing rule apply to these new circumstances when they're sort of using an old credit report? The answer is yes, because you're using a consumer report to price the loan, and these are two different transactions. We say in the rule that there's only one notice required per transaction, but because these are two different loans, a different notice would be required even though you're using the same credit report for both transactions. There are a number of questions related to that about, okay, well, how do we do this? I think that's going to be an easier case for risk-based pricing notices. Based on the questions that we've received, a lot of you are these new loans that are being taken out. People are coming in a pretty short time period after the original loan and after the original score or report was pulled. So probably you're going to be in the same sort of sampling period. You're going to be able to perform the same analysis. So what you would do is apply the information, the old report, to the analysis that you've already chosen. And then, if necessary, provide the risk-based pricing notice to the consumer. I think credit score disclosures may be harder, especially now that the rule is relatively new, because, you know, you may have an old score from 2 months ago that was provided before the rule was in effect and before some of the credit bureaus We're providing the supplementary information that also needs to be provided in the credit score disclosure. I think, and therefore you won't have that extra information. This problem will probably take care of itself in time, but the bottom line is that the credit score and the other required information has to be provided in order to comply. And so if necessary, it may be necessary to pull a new score in order to get the information you need, all of the information you need to comply with the rule. And let's see, we've gotten some questions about timing of credit score disclosures. As Rebecca mentioned in her presentation, you've got general timing requirements for the H3 mortgage notice and the H4 notice for other types of loans. And those, the H3 notice must be provided when the 609G notice is currently provided, and the H4 notice language that's used in the rule is as soon as reasonably practicable. Now, we don't, in the rule, we don't define what that means, but we do say in the preamble that from our understanding that the in the real estate mortgage context, that that's typically provided within 3 days of pulling the credit score. For other types of loans, you know, it may vary depending on the type of loan or the circumstances of the transaction. But for many types of transactions, we'd probably be expecting to see, as soon as reasonably practicable, being a matter of days, again, rather than a longer period of time. And to address another question, this also means that these can be given at the time of application. So that's something that is different from the risk-based pricing rule. You can give the credit score disclosures as early as the application. You don't have to wait for the credit decision to be made. And I think Rebecca's got some questions about whether a notice can be given at closing.
We received a question that asked in the installment loan context, if a loan closes within a couple of days, can notices be given at closing? If the entire installment loan application and closing takes place within a couple of days, then delivering the notice at closing would be an acceptable practice because it is provided within a reasonably practicable time. And then we got the same question with respect to real estate loans, and the answer is different here. Generally, this would not meet the requirements of this section due to the increased time to process real estate applications. The credit score disclosures must be provided with the 609G disclosure, which, you know, as Mandy just discussed, is typically within 3 days of pulling the credit score. And since a real estate transaction wouldn't close that quickly, a bank should not routinely provide this notice at closing.
Okay. We got a number of good questions in the context of renewals and modifications and refinancing type of credit. The questions we got about what notice is actually required for these different types of transactions. There are good ones. They're also very fact-specific, since, as you may know from the truth in lending realm, whether or not there's a new transaction really falls under the interpretation of you know, whether there's a modification or refinancing under state law. Is there satisfaction and replacement of old money? So you might be familiar with some of these issues, but I guess I can give you some things to consider when you're sort of trying to figure out, well, is this really more like an account review that's not, you know, really a new extension of credit where an account review notice might be required, Or is this actually, you know, a new transaction requiring one of the other disclosures? So first, think about this. What you're currently doing for these types of transactions under Truth in Lending and Reg Z requirements. Do you have a modification, which is really might be suggest that maybe just an account review notice is required, or do you truly have a refinancing and that's requiring new disclosures under Truth in Lending and definitely a new transaction. One of the other questions you might want to think about is for mortgage transactions, what are you currently doing for 609G requirements? Especially if you're, you know, providing the H3 notice, which covers both 609G requirements and also the risk-based pricing requirements, you know, you may already be giving pretty much the same information. So think about those types of things. And certainly, you can give our office a call to follow up if you have any specific questions related to a certain fact pattern.
The next question we received dealt with the provision of the 609G disclosure. If the bank is not using the credit report to determine pricing. So if a bank is pricing is not based on the credit report, the bank can continue to use the current 609G disclosures if they have determined that that disclosure meets the requirements of the Act.
Okay. Some questions about Dodd-Frank amendments. Will the agencies provide guidance or model forms to address the revisions to the risk-based pricing rules under Dodd-Frank? For those of you who aren't aware, there's the big financial reform legislation that came out last year with the Dodd-Frank Act. It actually includes some amendments to the rules that we're talking about for the risk-based pricing rules. The Federal Reserve Board and the FTC have been working on some proposed rules to address these new provisions and hope to get these proposed rules available publicly pretty soon. So I just encourage you all to keep an eye on the board website and look for an announcement of these proposed rules. And once they're proposed, I'd encourage you to comment about, you know, your reactions to the rules, problems you might see with the rules, that kind of thing, because that can really help inform what some final rules might look like for that. More questions about auto lending, which are good questions. I'll go over just highlight some of the things I talked about in my presentation. I know this can be a tricky issue. Again, just to reiterate, remember the person who has the responsibility is the one who has the original, who is the original creditor, and that in two-party financing, the bank can arrange for a dealer to provide the notice on its behalf as long as it's got some policies and procedures in place. There was also a question about how to provide a notice when there might be some automated decisioning. And I think that might be a good question to take offline since I'll need to know more facts. But I guess one of the questions I would ask is whether a notice can also be provided automatically. So, for example, can a credit score disclosure also be provided in the automation process?
There was one question that seemed to have differences of opinion as to when the H5 model form should be used. In general, if there's no credit record found, then that would mean that there's no accompanying credit score. Therefore, the H5 form would be used in that situation.
Okay. Got a question about how often should a consumer should consumer credit score rankings be updated? This is the part in the credit score disclosure about how the consumer's credit score compares with other U.S. consumers. We don't specify this in the rule, but we do state this in the preamble, that we expect this to be provided by the credit bureaus who are going to be providing this information and updating it periodically. And to our knowledge, this is being done by the bureaus provided, and they're providing the creditors with this information and updating it periodically.
The next question stated that Equifax states that the range of scores is 334 to 818, but this particular lender had been told that they should use the range of 300 to 850. Which range of score should be used? The rule requires a creditor to use the distribution of credit scores among consumers who are scored under the same scoring model that is used to generate the credit score that is used by the agency. If Equifax is stating that the range of scores is 334 to 818, then that is the range that should be used.
Okay, I'm mindful of our time here, so let me just try to get to some final questions. Question about guarantors and co-signers. Under the rule, they're co-borrowers, or jointly borrowing for a loan, are both required to be provided a notice under the rule, but guarantors and co-signers are not. We got one question about spouses in community property states that are not co-borrowers and whether this fact would change anything about the situation. For our purposes, spouses, again, if they're not co-borrowers, only the one who's actually the borrower would need to receive a notice, and the other spouse would be, I guess, more akin to a cosigner or guarantor who, again, is not required to receive a notice. Our lenders are required to disclose proprietary scores and credit score disclosures? No, you may, but you may also instead just use a credit score that's provided from a credit bureau. But either way, all the sort of extra accompanying information, all of the information must be provided. Is there a penalty for giving risk-based pricing notices to all consumers, both commercial and consumer? Let me just remind you that risk-based pricing notices should not be given to all consumers or all consumers. Remember, it's only to those who receive less favorable terms. I think the problem with also giving it to commercial customers is that, again, there's that free credit report that is being provided. So if they are being given a risk-based pricing notice, this is also giving them a free notice, which was not the intent of Congress. Congress only wanted this to be given to consumers. Mobile home loans. Question about whether they should give a mortgage disclosure or a non-mortgage disclosure. The rule does not address this, and whether or not a mobile home is considered a mortgage loan or a non-mortgage loan is really going to be probably going to be informed by the laws of your state. So we just expect you to treat the loan as it would be under state law, provide whichever notice would be appropriate for your circumstances. Question about the direct comparison method. What length of time does a creditor have to go back to compare its consumers? You know, a year, longer, shorter? It's not specified in the rule, but we say in the preamble that a creditor using the direct comparison method would have to demonstrate that it goes back far enough for a good sample, but that a sample is done frequently enough that it accounts for changes to its customer base, product offering, and underwriting criteria. Again, this is just not a place where we can give some hard and fast rules since it's just highly fact-specific. Final questions. Let's see. May the H-3 form be issued to all consumers, even if they apply for a different type of loan product? So I guess the question is getting at, can you provide the H-3 and not distinguish between the H-3 and H-4? The H-4 is very similar with information, but the H-3 has some extra information, and there are some segregation of information requirements for the H-4 non-mortgage loan. So no, for the mortgage ones need to be given for the mortgage loan disclosures, but because of that extra information, they can't be given for non-mortgage products and maintain a safe harbor under the rule. Can a credit card lender use the credit score disclosure? Yes, that's fine. There's nothing to prevent the credit card issuer from taking advantage of the credit score disclosure exceptions. And I think with that, Jason, I'm going to turn it over to you since we're out of time.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mandy, for taking some extra time to go over some additional questions. As you can guess, we've received a lot of questions during this webinar, and because of the volume of questions, we will likely do a Q&A article in the Outlook magazine, so look out for that. But I would like to thank our presenters, Mandy Aubrey and Rebecca Reagan. We were lucky to get their perspective regarding risk-based pricing notices. We hope you also found this presentation useful. As soon as the presentation ends and you exit the main menu, a short feedback form should appear on your screen. It may not appear if you have your pop-up blockers set. In that case, you can select the survey tab before exiting the main screen to access the feedback form. We would appreciate it if you could take just a couple of minutes to let us know what you liked about the presentation, any suggestions for improvement, and possible topics for future calls. I want to stress the importance of your feedback, not only on ways we can improve these events, but also on other ways in which we can continue a productive dialogue with the industry. Thanks again for joining us. That does conclude our call. Please look for future announcements on future events. Thank you.